Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. As we mentioned a couple weeks ago, we're going to spend the next few weeks talking about specific cases and some of the investigative challenges and victories that come about from some of the press releases that come out there and those implications and opportunities for the SIU community, the auditing community to get involved with some of the cases that are out there. I'm joined, of course, with my two partners in crime, Wade McFaul, retired assistant special agent in charge from the OIG office in LA and now a manager on our SIU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, whose resume appears to get longer each time you talk to him because he keeps getting more and more projects here at Advise. But Matt is the current payment integrity director, runs all of our SIU and investigative work here for our payment integrity team, and is the retired Northeast UPIC director and retired special agent in charge from the OIG. I'm still Eric Rubenstein, the senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse. I keep looking at my driver's license and passport, hoping that it'll change, but it's not. So I guess I'm stuck with you guys for the time being until I'm on a wanted poster or a milk carton. So today we want to talk about a case that was in the press towards the end of last week. It was out of Boston. It involves a guy by the name of James Rausch, R-A-U-S-C-H. And according to the press release, he conspired with two managers of a transcranial Doppler or TCD company that did mobile testing. You know, it appears they went to doctor's offices and things of that sort. He's from New York. The case was out of Boston. So that leads us to believe that this was probably a company that had a national footprint. It looks like he was charged in May of 2025, according to the press release, and pled guilty June 13th or 14th. So that's an interesting one. First, he was charged on May 25th and pled guilty 3 weeks later, which means to me one of a couple of things. Right, Wade? He was either cooperating or the evidence was overwhelming and he took the plea. You know, you typically see things like that. It says that he conspired with two of his managers and they didn't name the company, which also, Wade, leads me to believe there's going to be a lot more that comes out of this. Because they have co-conspirators. So, you know, that when you read the press release, a couple things stand out. The kickbacks that were being paid were a combination of cash and checks, and they were masking the kickback payments as either rental agreements or consulting agreements. And, you know, we talk about this a lot on the podcast about how from the SIU, the non-law enforcement perspective, because there isn't subpoena authority, that sometimes you're limited in what you can do vis-a-vis a kickback case, which we've all worked them, and kickback cases are a lot of fun, particularly when you have a cooperating witness. They're really a lot of fun to work. But from the SIU perspective, you can be limited. A lot of it's going to be data driven and things of that sort. And so, Wade, you know, the thing that always stands out on a kickback case with something like this in the data is going to be what are the referral patterns, the diagnoses, things of that sort. So let's talk about that. What are some of those things you want to look for, and what are some of the things that are going to raise an eyebrow for you?
Right. Well, you know, some of these things, as we refer to them as flags, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's fraud, like the same diagnosis. If you're doing transcranial Doppler procedures or tests, likely the people are going to have similar diagnoses. So that's an issue, but maybe not an issue. But the ones that we keep going back to that really is an issue is we're probably going to see in cases like this. I haven't looked at the data files, but there was most likely, if these are based on a kickback, there's most likely no previous relationship, you know, no referring physician that the patient or the member has seen on a regular basis. There's probably no follow-up on these tests. Again, so if you're having a test, you're going to want to get what the results are of the tests were. Otherwise, the tests didn't really have any medical purpose. It was strictly for getting paid the kickback. So those are the things that should really pop out in the claims data in the patient's medical history. The other thing that's interesting on this, I think, is the fact that they paid some of the kickbacks in cash, which tends to lean towards they're trying to cover up the kickbacks. You know, it's a little bit harder to follow cash as it is for a check. So, you know, trying to get in the mind of who's paying the kickbacks, you have a couple other things that were kind of alluded to in the press release. One is that they had agreed. First of all, there's certain safe harbors from kickbacks. Kickbacks by themselves are illegal, but there are a lot of exceptions to kickbacks or safe harbors, some being personal service agreements, space rental, if it's space rental for market value, equipment rental. You can have somebody brought on as a bona fide employee. There's flat fee services, but all these things have to be documented. It should be reviewed by a healthcare attorney, not just a general attorney, because the minutiae in these makes all the difference in the world. You can have two very similar looking agreements, whether it be personal service or space agreement or whatever, that look very similar, might look identical to the untrained eye, even to the non-healthcare attorney. So it's important to have those reviewed by somebody who's really experienced in that. And the other, I think, kind of the final point on these agreements is the fact that you have them written down and it's a contract. If you don't follow that, these exceptions are based on the referrals not being based on volume or number, no quid pro quo. So if you have these agreements that are supposedly exceptions to the kickback, but you're not following them, and even if it says on the contract that, you know, it's spelled out that it's not based on volume or a quid pro quo, if you're paying based on volume, you change those things out, the agreement isn't worth the paper that it's printed on. So that's the main thing. And that's where you have to have your general counsel or your compliance team. We've talked before about how same thing with the compliance plan. If it's not followed and, you know, reviewed on a regular basis, it's a living document. Just because you have something that you generated and printed out and put in the file a year ago, that's not going to protect you if you're not following what that plan sets out, just like a compliance plan.
Yeah, and you know what you're talking about in these safe harbors, in the sort of technical parlance, they call it designated health services or DHS. And the thing that's tricky about that is that list gets updated or changed frequently. At least every year, I've seen different iterations of it. And so the point you're making, Wade, which is good, is there are carve-outs, and you've got to understand, do you have a legitimate carve-out or not? And one of the big things in the rental agreements is that the rental agreement has to be set in advance for 1 year. It can't be volume-based. And actually, Office of Counsel to the Inspector General has put out a methodology for calculating what fair market value rental amounts are. So I've seen lease agreements that on their face looked entirely legitimate, that included the OIG's metric for the calculation. So I remember seeing one where they actually went on and in the lease agreement it said, per the Office of Counsel to the Inspector General's guidance dated, and they actually had it because it was part of like an advisory opinion or something, and they actually had it in the lease. It was horse shit. Because it was, they were still paying kickbacks, but you know, the takeaway, Wade, is the document could just be worth the paper it's written on, right? And if you have a real estate lawyer is going to say, hey, this looks good, and a healthcare lawyer is going to say, you know, no, this doesn't look good. But that to me was a pretty amazing one, because that lease was entirely bogus. It was volume based. They were paying kickbacks. And the lease agreement, it literally was for a broom closet. If you looked at the aggregate, the provider, it was something like $15,000 a month in rent. And the lease said Monday through Friday, 8 to 4. It was supposed to be for a mobile ultrasound diagnostic company. They did TCDs and a bunch of other things. And it was like $15,000 a month. We had gotten a hold of the lease that the provider receiving the kickbacks had with the landlord. His entire rent was like $3,000 a month. So he was making, like, you know, his profit was obscene. And it was like a 3x3 storage closet, right? So yeah, you have to look at these things with a grain of salt. And so Matt, that brings up kind of this other point, which is that from the SIU perspective, we don't have subpoena authority. We don't have certain types of investigative authority. But I think investigators are sometimes not really thinking a little bit, I hate to say outside the box, but a little bit more freeform, is What does the network agreement, what does the provider manual say about documents that you have to turn over or that you have access to? Because investigators could get access to a lot of other documents that they may not be thinking of, such as lease agreements, because you may be entitled to those as part of that. But also, and I know you want to talk about, you know, one of the cases that we worked on here where we found some absurd things, but you can do things like figure out some fair market value assessments. You can do some, you know, a little bit of sleuthing on your own and kind of figure out where there may be some issues on the arrangement that the provider has with this ancillary provider.
Yeah, you really need to check the, excuse me, the contracts with the providers and what they are obligated to provide to support the claims that they are submitting. So in many ways, it goes above and beyond just the medical records themselves. It could be timesheets for people, sign-in sheets. In some instances, it is contracts and lease agreements, consulting agreements, because, you know, those are generating claims because of these agreements. So you can get those either from the renter or the rentee, get those agreements because they're generating claims based on those. So that is a good thing to do. Another is open source open sources of information, realty.com, whatever it might be, will show you what the square footage price is in particular areas. You might be able to get blueprints of the buildings itself to see what is the square footage that's being rented. Is it actually what's in the contract, or is it a broom closet? Is there even space there to rent? How often is, you know, and then you go to the rental agreement, how often are they coming there? And then you can calculate what are they actually being paid per square foot? And is it in line with the average square footage and in line with the OIG's requirements? You know, another is you can do interviews of folks. You know, Wade brought up, I'm going to talk about the case in a minute, but Wade brought up, you know, the test being part of the medical program for the patient. If they're just doing the test, never get the results or never use the results, talk to the patients about that. Did they ever talk to you about the results of these tests? Yes or no? We had lots of TCD cases. The patients never heard the results of the tests. For us, it was, and going back to the data, optometrists that were the referring physicians. So they were these people's physicians. You usually don't see an optometrist referring someone for a TCD. Usually it's a neurologist or a specialist of, you know, of that sort, because these tests are usually used for stroke victims or stroke people at risk for stroke. So an optometrist doing this, way out of the ordinary. So going back to the data, you see all of these tests for TCDs ballooning where all the referring physicians are optometrists. That's a red flag. That's a lead. So you can use that data. But in the case that we, you know, we had in New York, not a TCD case, but our investigators went in, looked at the real estate, because it was an adult daycare center, and it was 2 or 3, sometimes 400 patients a day going into this adult daycare center and being billed. So we, you know, we pulled up blueprints of the building. We took pictures, got Google Earth pictures of the building. A, it was condemned. B, we looked into the square footage of the space. It was basically a two-bedroom apartment. There's no way you're going to get 400 people in there. They had they didn't have the kitchen facilities available for that amount of people. So it was just impossible for this place to do to provide the services that they were billing for. So using those open sources of information, you can go a long way in putting together a case that, you know, can go beyond what an SIU can do, without having the subpoena authority or search warrant authority. You can do it, you know, just with the resources you have. You know, Google Earth also, you know, for a lot of kickback cases, there is no NPR, no prior relationship between the referrer and the patient. You know, where do they live versus where is the doctor located?
Right.
Is there a large amount of space, you know, miles between them? Why would that doctor know anything about this patient? They're 200 miles away from them, never have a billing for them, but yet they're referring them for a TCD? Makes no sense.
Yep. And what you're really talking about, so when you're talking about this open source, is sometimes they call it open source intelligence, right? OSINT. You see that a lot. There are a lot of companies out there that charge fees to do, you know, deep and dark web investigative work and things of that sort. But, you know, we're not taking that super deep dive. Remember, not law enforcement. So we're doing that as on this topical level. And you're right. You can find, you know, Google Earth when you get down to Street View and you scroll across on Street View and you find the building is unoccupied. Another source for that is a lot of times city and county agencies have lists of condemned buildings, foreclosed on buildings, and things of that sort. So you can do that. You can certainly go up online, look at what commercially reasonable square footage is for commercial buildings in a similar location from some of the websites that are out there that do rental properties and things of that sort. It may not be an exact, right, but it at least gives you some idea about where you are on that commercially reasonable piece. And that's a great example. The building is condemned. The building is closed. The building has a permit that says occupancy of no more than 50 people or, you know, whatever. The thing that always gets
me on... It was residential. Yeah, it wasn't supposed to be
used. Yeah, it's residential. The thing that always gets me on instances where the services being provided to the patient are ancillary services like mobile diagnostic ultrasounds and things of that sort. You know, most of the time, those providers are not going to the referring doctor's offices, but once a week or once every other week. And so the question becomes, why is this even a thing? I mean, if I'm a patient and my doctor tells me I need an ultrasound, I get that there's a convenience factor. If I live in the neighborhood, I don't have a car, transportation is hard, particularly if you're an elderly or a Medicaid recipient, you don't have the money to go where you need to go. Maybe you wait the 2 weeks. But if I have a prescription for an MRI, an ultrasound, something, and I don't want to, I want to get it done tomorrow. I want to get it done today. If my doctor says you need an ultrasound, I want to get it done today. And so that's where I think another piece of this puzzle is going to be, when was the E&M with the patient relative to when that test was rendered? You know, I would expect that if the patient has a TCD, that there was an E&M within a little bit, maybe within a week or two, if it's a mobile diagnostic place and they're coming in every other week or something like that. So, you know, that's another thing to look at is when was the test that the patient got relative to when their last visit was, meaning did they see the doctor 6 or 7 weeks ago and now there's a TCD? What's the wait time on that? What are the medical records saying? So it's a lot of pieces of the puzzle that the data can show you. But, you know, I know from some of the work that we've done on those adult daycares that the Google Earth and Google Maps and the kind of, you know, human version of geolocating and saying this just doesn't look right. And particularly if you happen to be working in an area and you're familiar with the area, right? It's a little different. When we were at the OIG, we worked regionally, right? You know your neighborhood, you know your area. If you're in an SIU and you're living in Florida and you're working for something in Arizona, you know, you have to do a little bit more homework, but, you know, to become familiar with that area. But, you know, Google Maps and Bing Maps and, you know, some of these things that are out there and those street level views really do help give you some of that. And then you take that coupled with your data and coupled with looking at referral patterns from providers. These are basic analytics. And this is why, right, on the CMS 1500, and Matt, I'll give you the last word on this, because we know that oftentimes captured fields on the CMS 1500 form don't always make it to the data that you're looking at. And so it is important that when you are looking at data, you're looking at a complete set of data, meaning the mandatory fields on the CMS 1500 have made it to the data you're looking at, right? NPI numbers.
NPI numbers, referring physician.
Referring NPI number, rendering NPI, addresses, all of that. Data that's missing is something that the SIU should be looking to get rectified with either payment integrity claims, something, right?
Right. Those are essential pieces of information that should be available to the investigator, to the SIU, because without it, you're somewhat working in the blind. You know, how do you identify the referring physician on the claim when it's just isn't there for you in the data? And that I'm sure there's leads that have been lost because of that. So having that data is very important. So you have to work with your, with the plan to get that information. We've been doing that over the course of the last 2 years, bolstering the data that we're receiving so that we're starting to get a more complete picture of what was on that claim form when it was submitted. The other thing I want to say is, you know, with these TCDs, look to see who the specialist is that referred these patients. And are they neurologists? Do these patients have a history of high blood pressure or have had similar types of tests in the past? Have there been a stroke victim in the past? The ones we initially saw were, again, referred by optometrists as part of their annual vision tests.
Right, right.
And they had no prior relationship with the TCD company, obviously, and no prior history in their medical history for any type of problems that would lead to this type of test.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because what you often see is that there's no indicator of the patient having a diagnosis of the thing that's triggered the TCD. And I think, I know I've talked about this, about a year or two ago, I worked on a self-disclosure involving an ophthalmologist, medical eye doctor, who bought a TCD machine for his office, and the primary diagnosis that was required suddenly became the primary diagnosis for patients that didn't need it. And he did a self-disclosure because he had people that were complaining. His employees were complaining about this, and some patients were complaining. And so he decided to get in front of his fraud. And it was about $2 million that he wound up having to pay back, $1.5 million or $2 million. But, you know, there is an important piece of this, which is, you know, what was the diagnosis becomes really important. You could look at the data and see how many of the patients had that diagnosis before TCDs and how many of them had that diagnosis after TCDs. Because the whole point is that you're diagnosing the person and doing the TCD as either a confirmatory or, you know, something along that way as part of the transactional care of the patient. So
yeah, these aren't screening tests. These are tests that are supposed to be based on the diagnosis of the patient.
Right. So the patient's supposed to have that diagnosis before you actually do the test. There should be an instance of seeing that diagnosis before the TCD is actually rendered. So, it's an important piece, and that's where that data comes in. And Wade, I know you love playing with data. I know it's one of your favorite things. But some of these things, you know, as we kind of wrap up here, some of these things can really be obvious, right? I mean, if suddenly the issue has to do with an uptick in a particular test, right, item, service, or procedure, it's really not much, there's not much data analytics that needs to be done to identify, like, what were the incidents of people getting TCDs before the machine or after the machine? If it's such an important test, why wasn't this provider ordering it for his patients? And equally as important, how do all of a sudden all of these patients suddenly have this diagnosis that they didn't have before? Mm-hmm. You can't say the TCD is what showed the diagnosis. You have to have the diagnosis first, because it's not a screening test.
Yeah, and you can simplify it down to it being outliers, whether it be an outlier that the volume, like it's the one provider that does, you know, 10 times more of the same test than anybody else, that type of an outlier, or an outlier in the fact that there was no previous relationship, you know, relevant diagnoses, anything like that. So you can really boil it down to, without, you know, really combing through the data, seeing those outliers that should kind of jump out at you just by doing some queries.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, look, from my perspective, I think that ancillary services are a humongous vulnerability for the payer population, whether it be Medicare, Medicaid, or commercial. Ancillary services can be a huge area of concern. Genetic testing, laboratory services, and then diagnostic testing are going to be three that come to mind that really do present some of the strongest areas in the FWA space. This case, $70 million billed, over $27 million paid. We don't know what the percentage was that the providers got, whether it was a percentage of the amounts paid or if it was a flat fee. I've seen, you know, flat fee amounts, $25, $50, whatever it may be. I've seen percentages. I think it fluctuates. But, you know, we've seen this. The $2.1 billion case, the catheter case, like all of these ancillary services, DME, these are all the areas of huge vulnerability. Unfortunately, a lot of these tie back to telemedicine. But, you know, in this case, this is old school kickbacks. Again, what's old, retro fraud, what's old is new. And so, again, I still think we're going to see some more out of this case. And I certainly think there were some cooperators because this one has all of the hallmarks of the closed door dealings with kickbacks. And so, you know, it'd be interesting to see when this case kind of resolves itself, if there are any additional facts that come out that talk about that. Obviously, the fact that this guy pled guilty within 3 weeks of being charged to me means he was either cooperating or there were a lot of people cooperating against him. And it may be that there were a lot of people cooperating against him because typically the cooperator gets sentenced last but pleads guilty first. So he might be he could be the guy that got himself into a pickle. So we'll see what happens with that. So interesting stuff. These press releases are coming out fast and furious now, and the dollar amounts are humongous. So it's going to be interesting to see. It doesn't look like anybody's slowing down for the summer.
Nope.
Probably not. So,
nope.
All right, gents, as always, good seeing you. And as always, everybody that tunes in, we appreciate it. Again, we're learning every week about groups of people that watch the podcast that we didn't even know about. And so we do appreciate that. Feel free, as always, to drop us a note about the podcast, any topics you're interested in, anything you want to see or hear us pontificate about or you know, give our perspectives about, whether our perspectives are right or wrong. But, you know, we'll give you our perspectives. You can send us a note at just go to the website, advise, ADVIZE, health.com. You can drop us a note. You can send us an email at hello@advisehealth.com. You can get us on LinkedIn, get your newsletter every week sent to you. And again, we appreciate everybody tuning in, and we'll see everybody on the next episode of OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you all.